athletes.
It was July 7th, and Puerto Rico's governor, Ricardo Rosselló, was on vacation in France, watching the title match of the Women's World Cup.
Go! To the U.S.!
It was the beginning of what would become a very bad week for Rosselló. They call him Ricky on the island. That was Sunday. By Tuesday, he was on a cruise ship, floating happily somewhere in the Mediterranean. That was when the leaks started circulating online. They were leaked messages from a group chat on the app Telegram between Rosselló and some of his friends and advisors, in which they were joking around about serious political issues. 2 days later, on Thursday, there were more leaks from the group chat. These ones included Rosselló making homophobic and sexist comments. It was the last thing Rosselló needed. Earlier that week, two high-level members of his administration had been arrested in a corruption scandal. So this was all too much. He cut his cruise short and flew back to Puerto Rico to deal with the fallout. Little did he know that less than 2 weeks later, following the biggest mass protests in the island's recent history, that he would go on television to address the Puerto Rican people and announce his resignation.
He tomado la siguiente decisión. Hoy les anuncio que estaré renunciando al puesto del gobernador efectivo el viernes.
From NPR and Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, the scandal that took down Puerto Rico's governor and the massive street protests that forced him to resign. We're going to spend the full episode today talking about the protests in Puerto Rico and why they happened. Later on, we're going to be hearing how women are at the center of this story, and we're going to hear from Melissa Mark Viverito, one of the targets of the governor's inappropriate chats. But first, let's bring in Julio Ricardo Varela. Julio is my co-host on In the Thick, our sister podcast. He's also the founder of LatinoRebels.com, and he's a frequent commentator on all things Puerto Rico. So, first of all, Julio, why don't you lay out for us the general story behind the chats?
Right. Ricardo Rosselló, he's a pro-statehood moderate Democrat, son of a former governor, Pedro Rosselló. Basically, he had a group chat in an app between Rosselló and 11 other men, which included members of his own cabinet and people who were not in official positions in the government, like the CEO of a marketing agency, his name was Edwin Miranda, and lobbyist Elias Sanchez, who was Ricardo Rosselló's campaign manager in 2016.
The full 889 pages of these chats were published by the Center for Investigative Journalism in Puerto Rico. So what was in these chats that got the people of Puerto Rico so upset?
Maria, what is not in these chats is kind of the question I think we should all be asking. There's a lot of sharing articles, a lot of memes, but much of it, it's like it's mocking political opponents. It's threatening people in the press, threatening women, really crude messages about women, anti-gay slurs, super machista, super like frat boy, disgusting.
So one of the most recognized quotes from this chat is referring to Melissa Mark Viverito. She's the former speaker of the New York City Council. In the chats, the governor refers to her by the Spanish word for whore, which is puta. And there's another one referring to the mayor of San Juan, Carmen Yulín Cruz. And somebody in the chat says, quote, salivating to shoot her. And Rosselló responds that they'd be doing him a favor. Something else that comes up is that they call men from the opposing party, the Popular Democratic Party. They say that they're gay. They make fun of fat people. They suggest that one female legislator used to work at a brothel. And then in another message, they write, quote, Ricky Martin is such a male chauvinist that he men because women don't measure up, period. Pure patriarchy.
Right. And these guys are being like complete jerks. they represent the white, male, privileged Puerto Rico political class, the elite, and the level of contempt, not only to political opponents, but Puerto Ricans in general.
But the truth is that hundreds of thousands of people didn't take to the streets of Puerto Rico just because some politicians were being jerks or using bad language. Behind the protests were years of simmering resentment towards Rosselló and his administration and towards the island's politicians more broadly. And this reaches back long before Rosselló. So here at Latino USA, we've been reporting on Puerto Rico for a couple of decades. We're going to go back into our archives and use some of that audio to help you understand the context. And we're going to look at some of these specific chats and understand why they have been so inflammatory, because there's a history here. Let's start with one of these leaked chats. This is from January 20th. Governor Rosselló and the others in the group chat are talking about the budget for the Department of Forensic Science. Now, at one point in the chat, one of the guys says,
"Ahora que estamos en ese tema, ¿no tenemos algún cadáver para alimentar a nuestros cuervos?"
And that translates to, while we're on the topic of forensics, don't we have some cadavers to feed our crows? So can you unpack this part of the chat?
Basically, this part of the chat is referring to the dead bodies after Hurricane Maria and the overloading of all these dead bodies in morgues that happened after the hurricane. So people were really angry at this joke.
And that's in part because people were already angry with Rosselló about how he handled the hurricane recovery and very specifically the counting of the dead after Hurricane Maria.
And the Rosselló administration, the weeks after the hurricane, kept insisting, Maria, that the death count was only 16.
In fact, when President Trump visited the island, he brought up this low death count as a kind of proof that Puerto Rico wasn't experiencing what he called, quote, a major catastrophe.
Every death is a horror. But if you look at a real catastrophe like Katrina, and you look at the tremendous hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people that died. Now, what is your death count as of this moment? 17?
16 certified.
16 people certified. 16 people versus in the thousands.
And then Rosselló is insisting, is confirming with Trump, basically saying, yes, President Trump, it was a low death number. This was the biggest political mistake Ricardo Rosselló has ever made. And what you saw after that, Maria, is that you saw so many journalists begin to prove that there was never a low death count after Hurricane Maria.
Here's a clip from a story that we did about the death count back in January of 2018. And the voice you'll hear narrating is producer Marlon Bishop, who's speaking with Omaya Sosa Pascual. She's a journalist at the Centro de Periodismo Investigativo. On the one hand, Omaya was hearing the official government death count. But on the other hand,
doctors were telling her a different story.
Saying, listen, we have a lot of people in the morgues. That's not normal.
They were telling her that bodies in the morgues in the hospitals were just piling up and that they were also getting these transfer patients coming in from other hospitals that were without electricity. And they were coming in so sick that they just die shortly after they arrived.
I was getting numbers from them. I got this week 5 transfers. They all died.
I mean, these were individual doctors who were looking at the situation in their hospitals and being like, people are dying, you know? So she said,
I think there's something big happening here.
There's probably a lot more deaths than what the government has counted.
So while we had our team on the ground in Puerto Rico, we interviewed Governor Rosselló's man in charge of the hurricane response, and he refused to admit that the official death count needed to be higher. You're going to hear producer Marlon Bishop here again. He just asked Pesqueda to explain why there's a spike of 1,000 deaths right around the time of the hurricane if only 16 people were actually confirmed victims. Let's roll that tape.
I cannot explain it. I can go by inferences, or I can go by rumors. We have to go by what we can prove.
Do you think it's possible that the number of people who may have died is more than we were able to validate?
And it's a question asked by each one of the media. The answer is, in a world of possibility, anything is possible. It could happen. Yeah, it could happen. Of course it could happen. But it doesn't mean that it happened. It doesn't mean that it's not the accurate count. It doesn't mean that, why didn't you do it? Well, why didn't we do what?
Julio, this was not on a private chat. This was a government official giving a reaction to a reporter, Marlon Bishop. And his kind of attitude is, it stands out as just being quite flip.
Yeah, and arrogant. And I also spoke to Pesquera, and he said, anyone who's asking this question has, quote unquote, Oliver Stone conspiracy theories.
Eventually, the public outcry intensified. Héctor Pesquera resigned, and Rosselló's government would be forced, in fact, to admit that they had botched the death count. The number that is now accepted by the government is almost 3,000 people from just 16 that they originally insisted on. Coming up on Latino USA, more from the leaked chats that brought Puerto Ricans into the streets.
Government went out of its way to convince the middle class that it was safe to lend their savings to government.
Stay with us. No te vayas.
Going on a big group trip always sounds good in theory, but it can get tricky when you get there and have totally different expectations. Check out NPR Life Kit's new guide on navigating group travel, or subscribe to Life Kit, all guides for all our episodes, all in one place.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and I'm with Julio Ricardo Varela, and we're unpacking some of the specific leaked chats from Puerto Rico's political crisis and some of the deeper context behind them. The next chat we're going to talk about revolves around the Financial Oversight Board that controls the purse strings for Puerto Rico. So, Julio, in a few sentences, what is the Financial Oversight Board?
Yeah, the Oversight Board is this unelected fiscal control board that essentially runs Puerto Rico's finances and looks into the debt crisis, bankruptcy process, and basically tells Puerto Rico, this is how you have to spend your money. The best way to explain it is imagine Puerto Rico is this teenager and wants to spend money. And then the fiscal control board is the mom. And guess who has all the money? Mom. And you have to listen to mom.
Right. So it means that the fiscal control board is actually quite controversial. It comes up in a chat message from the governor, and it says in English, "Dear Oversight Board, go f*** yourself." And then the governor adds in the chat six middle finger emojis. Now, the thing is, Julio, that this is a sentiment that, in fact, many of the protesters and people in Puerto Rico agree with.
Right. And to be honest, Rosselló, when he campaigned in 2016, said basically the board is a bad idea. He wasn't a supporter of the fiscal control board. It does like bring up sentiments and proves that the board is not popular in Puerto Rico. And also it brings up the notions of this debt crisis that's been going on for years, that's now being restructured around $120 billion in debt and pension obligations. And the Puerto Rican people know that government officials, previous administrations, we're just spending and spending and borrowing and spending and borrowing. And Puerto Rico was in a financial quicksand.
Last year, we collaborated with WNYC in New York to produce a special on the financial crisis in Puerto Rico. And we spoke to a Puerto Rican economist named Elias Gutierrez, who lost much of his retirement when Puerto Rico defaulted on its bonds. And he was pretty mad about it.
Government went out of its way to convince the middle class that it was safe to lend their savings to government. It's a psychological blow, too, you know? It's like when you break a glass and then it falls and it breaks in millions of little pieces. That's what happened with our credibility. And it will take decades to mend. No matter what we do.
Elias's story is the story of many Puerto Ricans. And that's the part where people don't understand. I think people outside of Puerto Rico don't understand the true indignation that has sort of been simmering over the last couple of years. And then you bring in this fiscal control board who's kind of telling everyone what to do. And the biggest strategy they have, Maria, is austerity.
Austerity, which would mean cutting back on spending.
Basically, coming in and saying we have to cut public schools, we have to cut pensions, we have to raise tuitions in the public universities. And Rosselló was put in a tough place. He was seen as someone that had to appear like he was working with the board, but he obviously didn't agree with the board. And there's a lot of people in Puerto Rico who were like, Ricky, why are you not fighting the board? Why don't you lead us? And that was sort of like a crisis in leadership as well.
In the same episode that we aired last year, we spoke to a student activist at the University of Puerto Rico. His name is Gabriel Negron, and he was fighting against the tuition hike for the public university. He said if tuition was raised, it would have a real impact on his life, and it would affect his decision as to whether or not he would stay on the island or leave.
I'm afraid that I'm going to have to take less courses next semester and take even longer to graduate, get myself in debt, because I'm going to have to find a job that's going to give me measly pay so I can barely pay the increase in tuition, everything else in four. Like, you know, it's easy to say I'm going to stay here, but once you get the chance to start all over, it's a decision that it's hard to take and that many people just decide to leave. Even as you try to run from thinking about it, at the end of the day, when you're in bed and you're consulting with your pillow, you're going to think about this and it's going to give you anxiety. Sometimes it feels that it's beyond your control, and we're making the efforts in preparing ourselves. We're preparing for the worst.
So next on the list of what was leaked in these private chats, yes, the governor and his buddy said a lot of nasty things about a lot of people, but they seem to reserve a special kind of hatred for independentistas. These are activists and part of a political movement in Puerto Rico that wants independence for the island. So after a pro-independence politician, Marta Font, passed away, one of the guys on the chat says, ¿Cuántos días de duelo? And another responds, un nanosegundo, which means how many days should we be in mourning? And the other one responds, a nanosecond. Why is there this anger for people who want independence for the island of Puerto Rico? And what does it mean?
Right, because this group have always feared, you know, the left as, oh, here comes Cuba and here comes Venezuela. And it shows that this is how they think about political opponents and different political ideology.
So the percentage of people who really support full independence on the island is small. But many people in Puerto Rico agree that the colonial relationship with the United States has not always been good for Puerto Ricans. Here's another clip from our archives, this one from former Daily News columnist and Democracy Now! Co-host Juan González.
I think that you have to deal with the reality that Puerto Rico has been a territorial possession. The rest of the world calls that a colony. You know, I use the analogy, it's easy to get married, it's hard to get divorced. When you no longer need a territory of 3.5 million people, but they are now U.S. citizens, what do you do with it?
So, Julio, how much of what we were seeing on the streets in Puerto Rico is like pro-independence, anti-colonialism? Is it ideological or is it something else?
You know, Maria, that's a great question because I don't think right now, I don't think this protest is a pro-independence protest. But I think this is a bigger movement. This is about putting Puerto Rico first, about starting to look at ourselves as what it really means to be a colony. What has that created in the psyche of Puerto Ricans for decades? And what I say to people is that this is not an independence protest yet. It's a protest to start a process of decolonializing our internal colonialism as Puerto Ricans. And what I mean by that is we've been a colony for so long, our shoulders are slumped down. We've been told that we can't do anything, that we are dependent on U.S. federal aid and dependent on our American citizenship. And these protests prove that wrong, Maria. You see the elevation of the Boricua, of the Puerto Rican, saying, I'm done. I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. I know that's a very old quote from a bad 70s movie, but I think that's what's happened. This indignation has led for a change in the system, and we're starting to see the colony beginning to get deconstructed.
Julio Ricardo Varela is my co-host on the podcast In the Thick from Futuro Media, and he's also the founder of LatinoRebels.com. So, to sum it up, there are a lot of deeper issues that brought Puerto Ricans to the streets. There's the way the governor handled the death count and hurricane recovery. There's austerity and financial mismanagement. And there's disrespect for Puerto Ricans and their different political beliefs. And as we mentioned earlier, there were many messages that were offensive, machista comments about the LGBTQ community and women. And one of the targets in those chats was the former Speaker of the New York City Council, Melissa Mark Viverito. And heads up, we're going to be hearing those inappropriate words used by the governor, and they won't be bleeped. Melissa was a councilwoman in New York, but she grew up until she was 18 in Puerto Rico, and she continues to be invested in Puerto Rican politics from afar. And she remembers the moment when she first realized she was mentioned by name in those private chats. She was about to get on an Amtrak train to Washington, D.C.
At 7 o'clock in the morning, I'm at Penn Station. And I get a call, and it's Senator Batia from Puerto Rico, and I'm like, why is he calling me at this hour? And so I answer, and he goes, ah, Melissa, ¿cómo estás? He goes, have you seen the chat? And I said, have you know what's going on? And I said, no, I don't. I have no idea. And he says, well, there's this information that's leaking out, and that there's this conversation of the governor and people in his administration, and you're mentioned. I said, okay. And he says, and he calls you a whore. And I said, oh, interesting. I had to board the train at that point, and I actually got into the quiet car on Amtrak heading to D.C., and next thing I know, my phone starts blowing up, and texts and calls and people saying, you know, that what actually had been indicated in the chat.
The governor's exact language when it came to Melissa Mark Viverito was...
Caerle encima esa puta. Caerle encima is to pounce upon that whore.
Once seated and settled in the train, Melissa was able to piece together the context of the messages about her.
They were responding to the tweet that I had sent to the chair of the DNC.
Tom Perez, the chair of the Democratic National Committee, had recently stated his endorsement of Puerto Rico seeking statehood. And Melissa didn't like that a fellow Democrat, a politician from the mainland, was trying to influence what she thinks only Puerto Ricans should decide for themselves.
Nobody should be trying to impose from outside what your destiny is going to be. The governor and his administration are pro-statehood. So any position that is expressed that doesn't embrace that openly is seen as an attack.
What the governor was really saying was that Melissa should shut up. Once she finally had a grasp of the gravity of the situation, she wanted to fight back.
And I wanted to tackle it head on. And I did that.
She called her mom and other Puerto Rican women who she calls on for guidance. And she wrote up a statement condemning the governor and his administration and his language. And she quickly posted this on Twitter.
Within an hour and a half, 2 hours, I put out that statement. And it, you know, got a lot of traction and a lot of support from people on the island. It was powerful to see how people started to galvanize.
That weekend, Melissa flew to Puerto Rico. And between Thursday and Saturday, massive protests had begun. Melissa joined in, marching on the streets of San Juan. The word puta, in my view, has kind of forever been changed.
Yes, I agree.
But that word, in fact, inspired these protests.
Again, a lot of people were stopping me, you know, saying that they were aware that I had been the target of the chats, expressing solidarity and support, and, you know, women in particular. And I would tell them, mira, ustedes saben que un ataque a mí es un ataque a todas nosotras. Right? That the attack is not just about me, it's about all of us as women. ¶¶
wasn't just women who were feeling solidarity with the former New York City councilwoman.
I was going to an interview on the day of the mass mobilization, and I get there, and the security guard man is walking me out, and he goes, "Ay, yo creo que la conozco ahora, entiendo quién es usted." And he was like, "I think I recognize you. I know who you are now." And he goes, "You're Viverito, right? You're the one that the governor was talking about." And I said, "Yes." And he told me, if I can say it in Spanish, he goes, "Bueno, ese hombre no me representa a mí, pero como hombre le pido disculpa."
The man said to Melissa, "The governor doesn't represent me, but as a man, I ask you for forgiveness." What Melissa Mark Viverito experienced, what was revealed in those graphic messages, is something that women living on the island are all too familiar with, the normalized mistreatment and disrespect of women, even at the highest reaches of government. Puerto Rico has the highest rate per capita in the world of women above the age of 14 being killed by their partners. In the past, women on the island have been subjected to forced sterilizations and have even been used as guinea pigs to test new drugs for the United States. All of which is to say that what those leaked chats revealed was not new. In their aftermath, though, what has become abundantly clear is that from the streets to the newsrooms, women are trying to change that narrative on the island. We invited three Puerto Rican women journalists to talk about their takeaways from the last weeks. Joining us from San Juan, Puerto Rico, is the executive director of the Centro del Periodismo Investigativo, Carla Minet. Also, Natalia Rodriguez Medina, who is with Latino Rebels, which is part of the Futuro Media Company. And Sandra Guzman, who's a Puerto Rican journalist and documentarian. So welcome to all three of you. Bienvenidas to Latino USA.
Gracias. Hello.
Hi.
Hola, hola.
Hola.
So, Carla, you head up the Centro de Periodismo Investigativo, which is the Center for Investigative Journalism in Puerto Rico. And it was your team. It's a team that is led by women. Actually, it was a woman journalist who broke the story about these chats. A lot of the chats were targeted at women in a misogynistic way. So women are kind of at the center of all of this. Tell me, what went on for you when you first got a hold of these messages and you started seeing what was in them?
I felt insulted. I was ashamed. Of course, I am a citizen and I am a woman. But we try to look at it from a accountability perspective in terms of what were the violations that were happening here. Because one thing is to know that somebody is not behaving correctly. But another thing is to see that this was not anecdotal. This was a pattern that was not only the governor participating, but all of his closest advisors. You know, it was a generalized problem.
Sandra Guzman, you were watching this from the mainland. You write a piece for CNN.com. It's called "Women in Puerto Rico Know All Too Well Why Rosselló Must Resign." And you basically say that these private chats kind of sent women to say, okay, yeah, se acabó. You know, we've had it up to here. What was that tipping point and what's the kind of history that got them to this point?
I remember when I first read about the attacks on Melissa Mark Viverito in New York and the governor and his buddies calling her a whore and encouraging violence against her and another mayor. I thought about how the personal is political and how the internal or intimate mindset of a politician, of an elected official, usually transfers into policy. And this governor basically was ignoring the women. And when the chats were revealed, it all became clear as to why the women have been ignored. They're not taken seriously.
All right. So, Natalia, you grew up in Puerto Rico. You actually were on the ground for the entirety of the protests from when they began up until the resignation. So I just want to say thank you for all of your great on-the-ground reporting for Latino Rebels. And so you actually grew up going to protests with your mom as a little girl in Puerto Rico. Now you're a journalist and you're covering the story. So did you see something different happening in the streets this time with these protests as opposed to when you were growing up? Was this more women-led?
I do believe it was more women-led, and it was very impressive because these have been happening for 2 weeks, and it wasn't just the big one on Monday that had, like, estimate a million people, but I remember one that was, like, the Monday before that, which was the first one that was called for Capitolio, and every single person who spoke and who was gathering people and who was motivating people were women. And they were, I remember that in the manifestos that they were reading, in the terms that they were asking, they weren't just asking for Rosello's resignation. They were also asking for something to be done about the domestic violence and the violence against women that's happening in Puerto Rico.
When you think about a protest that was, in a lot of ways, sparked by women, led by women, because you were on the ground really witnessing history in an extraordinary way, you know, hundreds of thousands of your fellow American citizens basically saying enough is enough. Is there a moment that you just kind of can't get out of your head?
So I think it was that same Monday. I don't remember the date. It was like 2 weeks ago, the first big one that was a march from El Capitolio to Fortaleza. My line of view was the cops, the barricade, and the people in the front. And a lot of the people in the front were young women who were holding their hands up saying, we're not throwing anything, we're not being violent, who were holding signs. And I just remember, it was so vivid. I have this clear image of women behind the barricade looking at these cops face to face saying, we're not afraid. We're here to march, we're here to protest, we're here to change.
The images that I love seeing were the women dancing as they're protesting. How did you see it from the mainland?
I remember going to bed and I saw all these live feeds of different people showing us images of the gassing taking place. And it was very disturbing, but I had to go to bed. And so the next morning, I woke up and I saw an image of all of these beautiful bouquets of flowers laid at the feet of those barricades that Natalia was talking about between the people and Fortaleza. And there were all these beautiful bouquets of all these resplendent tropical flowers. And the flowers were for Maria's dead, which I understand in the chats were made fun of, were being contemplated to being fed to the crows. But I remember being very emotional about the flowers at the feet of the police officers that hours earlier had gassed these people. It was very beautiful to see how peaceful these protests were and how creative they were. In fact, I just finished writing a piece for NBC News calling it the most beautiful revolution the world has ever seen because we protested in such magnificent ways. There was drumming, bomba y plena. There was dancing.
I would like to say that, on the other hand, yes, this was a peaceful protest, but force was still used against protesters at some points. There were some people and youngsters that were hurt and women that were hurt because of how police behave at the most tense moments. But, I just want to acknowledge that some people were hurt.
I did see a lot of, especially being behind police lines, I did see how unprovoked police got very, very violent for no reason whatsoever. And I'm not sure if you guys have been scouring. Everything that Carla just said is true. Police were very, very aggressive. We saw a lot of cases of police brutality. We saw a lot of videos on social media of people getting beaten with billy clubs. We saw people getting shot with rubber bullets. We saw people getting gassed in residential areas. But to add to that and to keep the topic of women, I don't know if you guys saw Cacerola Girl.
Yes.
Who became an instant internet icon. And honestly, one of the biggest shows of bravery I've ever seen in my life, which was this girl who had a cacerola, which is like a saucepan. And she was like banging the cacerola with the cops in her face. She had like 20 police officers on her. And she was just staring at them. Standing her ground and saying, I'm not afraid of you. I'm going to continue my protests. And it was one of the most spectacular things and one of the most awesome examples of women being brave in these circumstances.
Coming up on Latino USA, my conversation with three Puerto Rican women journalists continues.
The novela doesn't end with Ricky Rosselló, and we're going to need all the voices to really amplify and reimagine this very beautiful place.
Stay with us. No te vayas. Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. We've been hearing from three Puerto Rican women journalists about what's been happening on the island over the last couple of weeks. We're joined by Carla Minet, whose team helped break the news of the leaked chats, Natalia Rodriguez Medina, who was reporting on the ground for LatinoRebels.com, and Sandra Guzman, who was watching and writing from the mainland. We're going to return to that conversation now. So part of the interesting moment, Latinas, women in this case, Puerto Rican women, are saying, we want to tell our stories, we want to be journalists, we're going to be professionals, but we want to control the narrative in how our stories are being told. So how do you think, Sandra, that the role of Puerto Rican women journalists has impacted what happened in Puerto Rico?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think about what El Centro and Carla and Omaya are doing. And I think about the fact that, you know, Puerto Rican women have always historically been fighting against this oppressive nature of the U.S. empire. I think about the brave women who in the 60s and the 70s told the story of La Operación and women being used as guinea pigs and being operated on. And historically, we have, as much as we can, controlled our narrative. And what is exciting now is that social media is allowing us to create our own blogs, to photograph and upload some of the images, and really tell our stories in different art forms as journalists, as documentarians. So this revolution that is transforming the Puerto Rican nation makes me proud to know that On the Ground has been led and continues to be led by women on the island and also here in the diaspora.
Of course, Puerto Rican women are not monolithic. You know, there are conservative women on the island who probably were not out protesting. How do the women of Puerto Rico handle that part of the dynamic going forward, knowing that, you know, it's going to get challenging and complicated?
Well, I think that what happened in this case is that since the chat, insulted so many groups, even if you were not part of one group, you were, vicariously part of any other. You know, they insulted women, LGBT, the death of Hurricane Maria. They insulted obese people. They mocked about journalists. They mocked about Ricky Martin, another artist, other public figures, you know, the mayor of San Juan, Melissa Mark Viverito. And even if as a woman, you didn't, you know, you're conservative and you don't take that as a direct offense to you, maybe one of the other groups that was bullied and insulted were people that were close to you. There were groups that were a very different demographic from the usual protesters in Puerto Rico. So that's why I would say, you know, even if you didn't feel insulted directly, some of your people were.
Carla, as we wrap up, what's your sense of what's going to happen in the future? What, do you think that this is a turning point? And what is the future mm-hmm. for women and for women journalists and your role in what's coming up in the future of the island?
Well, this is, yes, I see this as a turning point. I think we are in a moment of opportunities for Puerto Ricans, for women, for journalism. You know, getting Rosselló out of La Fortaleza is not going to solve Puerto Rican problems. You know, these are deep problems that don't go out with Rosselló or even his closest allies. You know, corruption, the loopholes in the justice system, La Junta de Control Fiscal and the austerity measures, the slowness in the recovery money, the federal recovery money coming into Puerto Rico, and the ineffectiveness of federal agencies dealing with the recovery process. All of these things are still there, even when Rosselló gets out. When I say this is an opportunity, is that this is an opportunity to keep, you know, working, to keep fighting, to keep looking for participation, for real participation from the people who are concerned and that want Puerto Rico to change, not in a superficial way.
So, Sandra, your takeaways. You do consider this a turning point. Why and what do you think is the future for the island in terms of women?
It is a turning point because you have a generation that will not stand by for more abuses. So he was, Rosselló and his buddies were equal opportunity haters. And I think people are more motivated for more accountability and transparency. It's very exciting to see that there's going to be more protests. The protests did not end. Maybe the coverage in mainstream media has ended, but people continue to go out and protest deeper, as Carla was saying, deeper, more structural changes, changes that are hindering the growth of the island, such as the junta and the colonial relationship that the island has with the United States. And as far as women journalists, and as far as myself as a woman journalist and documentarian, I will continue to use my platforms and my voice to report on the ground, to report and to amplify what is happening on the island. I am excited for how people are reimagining a new Puerto Rico. And part of it is cleaning out all of the corruption. And as Carla said, the novela doesn't end with Ricky Rosselló. And we're going to need all the voices to really amplify and reimagine this very beautiful place.
And finally, Natalia, you're the next generation of Puerto Rican women journalists. You're just starting out your career. What's your sense of not only what the future looks like, but your particular role?
Well, to quote the song that Residente, Ile, and Bad Bunny said, I come from the generation de la generación que yo no me dejo. It means the generation that I won't let you guys touch me. I won't let you guys ruin my chances. I won't let you guys ruin my future. So I feel like my job is very important right now, and I continue to do it. And yeah, yo no me dejo. I will continue.
ni tu propia gente. Vamos a prender en fuego a tu gabinete. Los títeres guardan las cortes y saquen los machetes. La cuna de la cría, con el boricua nadie se mete. Todas las paredes dicen Ricky Vete.
Thank you so much. Thanks to all of you. Natalia Rodriguez Medina, Carla Minet, and Sandra Guzmán. Thank you so much for joining me on Latino USA for this great conversation.
Se roben todos los chavos de educación mientras cierran escuela y los niños no tienen salón. Ey, es hora de sacar la rata, que se vaya Ricky, que se vaya el otro, que se vaya Tata.
This is not the first time the people of Puerto Rico have taken to the streets, nor is it the first time the women of the island have been at the forefront of history. When you've got nothing to lose, like the people of Puerto Rico, disrespected by the President of the United States and by their own governor, then you lose all fear. The people of Puerto Rico have protested consistently on the island, not for months or even years, but for decades. And here's the thing, all of us are impacted by the activism on the island because Puerto Ricans are our fellow American citizens. Protest creates a legacy and an image of what one form of democracy looks like, and we learn from that. Among the things that the people of Puerto Rico have done is to get the American military off the island of Vieques in 2003, which is unprecedented. They also had one of the longest student strikes in American history. And in terms of electoral politics, Puerto Rico has had one of the highest voter participation rates in the Western Hemisphere. For Puerto Ricans, elections are an essential expression of their political life. The people of Puerto Rico have taught us what it looks like when you use every democratic avenue you can to seek change. People power, the press, and street protests, with amor and flores, love and flowers, and definitely, most definitely, dance. And finally, we're going to leave you with a montage from the protests, the sounds of artists and people making history.
Puerto Rico, Ricky Martin aquí.
El perreo intenso acaba de comenzar.
They put down women. They put down the LGBT community. People with disabilities, corruption. We are tired. We
voy a estar allí en Puerto Rico manifestándome.
El perreo intenso acaba de comenzar.
He tomado la siguiente decisión. Hoy les anuncio que estaré renunciando al puesto del gobernador efectivo el viernes 2 de agosto del 2019.
Latino USA is produced by Miguel Macias, Antonia Cerejido, Maggie Freeling, Janice Yamoca, and Sayre Quevedo, with help this week from Marlon Bishop and Ginny Montalvo. We're edited by Fernanda Camarena and Sofia Paliza Carr. Special thanks this week to Julio Ricardo Varela and Natalia Rodriguez Medina. Our engineers are Stephanie LeBeau and Julia Caruso. Our production manager is Natalia Fidelholtz. Our New York Women's Foundation Ignite Fellow is Jess Alvarenga. Our interns are Lucas Southard and Jonathan Cabral. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. If you like the music you heard on this episode, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next time. And in the meantime, look for us on all of your social media. Hasta la próxima. Ciao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by Heising Simons Foundation, unlocking knowledge, opportunity, and possibilities. More at hsfoundation.org. The Wincote Foundation. And the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
Natalia, you almost made me cry, yo.
Yo no me dejo. Beautiful.
Blame Bad Bunny.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, and next time on Latino USA, we get personal with actress Gina Torres, the star of the new TV series, Pearson. That's next time on Latino USA.